they treat people like they worth nothing.
Injustice kind of chose me because it brushed against me many times.
It looked like Baltimore had been in a war.
The loss of potential, not simply Freddie Gray, but all those young folks.
And here I am thinking that I'm supposed to be this thug.
A war on drugs is not, it's not a war on drugs anymore. It's a war on us.
I'll take you back to the street. They treat people like they worth nothing.
Welcome to the world that brought us Freddie Gray.
A five-part radio documentary produced by students at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
In collaboration with Baltimore Traces.
This week, we've heard many accounts of the current state of Baltimore and the Sandtown Winchester neighborhood, where Freddie Gray grew up and where he was arrested by police last year. In this episode, we attempt to answer the question, where do we go from here? This week, you have heard the voices and stories of people who live in Sandtown, Winchester, an analysis of history and public policy from activists, lawyers, and former police officers, and an exploration of how the law, policing, housing, and education policies led us to the place where Freddie Gray, a young man who committed no crime, would die as a result of being arrested by Baltimore City Police. The jury of public opinion is still out about how much has changed in Baltimore communities like Sandtown. People inside of that community and across the city have very different perceptions of present reality and what the future may hold. Jeff Singer, former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless in Baltimore, addressed the reality that the poverty level in Baltimore increased from 17% in 1973 to 24% today.
Since 1980 in the U.S., there's been this massive explosion of homelessness. And Mark and I almost only barely can remember a time when you could walk down a street in a city and not see someone who was homeless. When we were growing up, this was not common.
Elder C.W. Harris, pastor and founder of the Jubilee Arts Center in Sandtown, who was also born and raised in that community, takes us back to what his Sandtown was like as a child.
In the 50s, we were what you call a ghetto. In other words, we were a race of people forced in the area because of racism. It was a segregated city, and the population of our community was about 40,000. For those who did not fare well, they had an opportunity to grow because they would see other folk around them, and we would help one another to get up to a level to where we could have comfortable living, especially in our surroundings, the surroundings that we were forced in because of the color of our skin.
Over the last 50 years, since the end of legal segregation in 1964, the riots after the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, the deindustrialization that left tens of thousands jobless, and the flight of the middle class and whites to the counties, left Baltimore's inner city black communities as wastelands, with abandoned homes, few jobs, or resources. Eddie Conway, a former Black Panther who is now an executive producer with the Real News Network, was shocked when he saw the conditions of many communities in Baltimore when he came home after spending 43 years in prison as a political prisoner.
When I got to Baltimore and looked at the houses, it looked like Baltimore had been in a war. And this is like 40 years later, of course, so, you know, if you leave someplace 40 years and come back to it, you expect it to be better, expect it to be advanced, expect it to have grown. But in Baltimore's case, it had actually collapsed.
Jeff Singer adds,
this market housing typology map is a map of where the city will not invest money to help people with housing. So this is another example of how public policy is creating segregation and discrimination and inequality. But the city itself is doing that. Supposedly people that we've elected to look out for our interests.
Morgan State University professor Dr. Lawrence Brown and Tara Huffman, a director at Open Society Institute Baltimore, observed that,
as we found out in a court case called Thompson versus Hood, you see that surrounding counties were actually sending their poor black people into Baltimore City's low-income housing, into Baltimore City's public housing. And so basically what you have is the wealth exiting the city, and then counties like Montgomery County, Howard County, Baltimore County saying, we don't want low-income black people living in our public housing, so we're going to dump them into Baltimore City. And so you literally had a scenario where wealth exits the city, poverty enters the city, and it clusters and it concentrates.
Baltimore City school students make up 10% of the entire state's student body. So 10% of students across the state live or go to school in Baltimore City. But if you break down school-based arrest, Baltimore City generates 90% of school-based arrest across the state. So of all of the arrests that happened in a given year, and there were 688 in 2013, 688 school-based arrests across the entire state of Maryland in 2013, and 90% of them were in Baltimore City schools.
The effects of de facto segregation, the over-policing of Baltimore communities, and isolation faced by people who live in these communities, like Sandtown, are ignored. We only begin to notice these problems when something like an uprising occurs, when CVSs are burned, and when the community confronts the police. As you've heard in this series, many are working to make a difference, to build community, and to change the face of Baltimore City. Elder Harris is one of those people working to change the environment, his community, and the mentality of people within it. He recently staged a protest on top of the Jubilee Arts Center. His goal was to get over 500 people from Sandtown to cast their votes in Baltimore's primary election. That was double the number of votes cast by Sandtown residents in the previous election. Before Election Day, Elder Harris motivated so many of his neighbors to vote.
Our community haven't seen really peaceful protesting. And so last year I thought out of the box, thinking which way that we could give a living demonstration of nonviolent, peaceful protest. And so I thought maybe I'd go on the roof, stay on the roof until we get more people to vote, more people to believe in the process, more people to honor those who have given their lives for us to have the opportunity to vote.
Michael Wood Jr., a retired Baltimore police sergeant turned activist.
We need a systemic institutional revolution. I think maybe what was achieved more so in the 60s was like a cultural revolution where we started to understand what was wrong, but we never took the time to reset our systems into so that the systems would reflect our moral and ethical values. So we left the systems in place thinking that if we just changed a few minds, things would happen. So my perspective now is I don't care so much about changing minds. I care more about changing the policy and the systems in place within policing so that there is the accountability, whether I'm there or someone else is there, it doesn't matter. It goes into the future so that it's locked into place.
Here's Bannard Woods, a reporter for The Guardian who covered the uprising for the Baltimore City paper.
I think ending the drug war is a huge thing that would fix a lot right now. And I mean, for that matter, legalize weed and allow there to be, instead of people getting arrested for selling it on the street there, allow there to be a store. Have the people who are being entrepreneurs already be able to be entrepreneurs that profit in a legitimate way.
Perry Hopkins is one of the lead organizers in the public housing projects with Communities United. He describes part of his vision for how things could change in Sandtown and similar communities.
Poor people need to be empowered with jobs, not moved out of their homes and wait for gentrification. And everybody knows it. It's blatant. Laws got to be put in place. People got to come together. It's a lot of pain in the poor communities.
The best way to do it, I feel, is a bottom-up approach.
Elder Harris.
It's going to take the people of the community who are struggling to really be the judge, the educators of those who do not know. Injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Developing different projects in the community that would support our community in with jobs, decent affordable homes, hoping that we get this crime wave down to our kids and the population of this community can feel like they can walk the streets safely.
It's good that we're having these conversations now, but I think it's the kind of conversations that we need to be careful of.
Boehner Woods.
Because it's trendy, you know, when there are the pegs, which we have to do in the news, but when it's an anniversary time and stuff, oh, we're going to look at this again and what's changed, and then we all forget for another year. And that's not the way, that's the thing that makes where change doesn't happen.
People across Baltimore are taking control of their communities and their futures. As you have heard over the last week, the obstacles to building a full life in communities like Sandtown Winchester are immense. But men like John Comer and women like Rochelle Barksdale and others devote their lives to building movements for change. Elder Harris is another one of those people, and he leaves us with a story that symbolizes the hope he envisions for the future.
I remember a story when I was in elementary school. It was called Stone Soup. A gentleman who came into a community and he was hungry and he wanted something to eat. And then they said that they didn't have anything to eat. And he said, "Have y'all heard of stone soup?" And they said, "No." He said, "Does anyone have a stone?" They said, "Yes, we have a stone." And he said, "What about a pot? Anyone have a pot?" Someone pulled out a pot. He put the stone in. He said, "How about some greens, vegetables?" And he just kept adding on potatoes. And the folks from the community gave him all of those things. All the resources to make good soup is here. It just had to, someone had to be innovative enough to think out of the box to bring all of that out, to bring all of what we have here out. Now, when other folks see that we are making chicken soup out of chicken feathers, folk from our surrounding communities are ready to pitch in and put in other things. Well, if you're that happy with a penny, let me see what you do with a nickel. That's how it happens.
Freddie Gray's death is an immoral bloodstain on Baltimore's collective conscience. The unequal application of law, the dysfunctional relationship between the police and Baltimore communities, the impact of the environment on children's ability to learn, and the legacy of segregation and housing all characterize the world that brought us Freddie Gray.
Over the past week, we've listened to the voices of Baltimore and their position on these issues. Change is incremental, and there is much work that still needs to be done. Freddie Gray lived in Sandtown Winchester, a neighborhood in West Baltimore that displays the consequences of these layered socio-political failures.
These issues are not only specific to Baltimore, they occur on a national level. Freddie Gray is one of many who died due to injustice. Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, and Tamir Rice are some of the people you may be familiar with. However, there are countless others we may never know.
It is evident that, when left unchecked, these failures prove to be fatal. For the sake of those who have suffered and those who will suffer, we cannot ignore the injustice of the environment any longer. Change requires time and volition. Where will you be in the movement?
The World That Brought Us Freddie Gray is a collaboration between UMBC students, the UMBC American Studies Department, Baltimore Traces, and the Center for Emerging Media. Production, research, editing, and voice work for today's segment on Solutions was done by Cody Selbert, Chris Lee, Claire Gutois, Jordan Grant, Evelyn Vartanian, Darian Kate, Tyler Walsh, Heather Harvey, and Terrell David, with executive production assistance by Mark Steiner, Stephanie Mavronis, and Adam Dromberg. We want to give a big thank you to the people whose voices were featured in today's episode: Jeff Singer, Elder C.W. Harris, Eddie Conway, Dr. Lawrence Brown, Tara Huffman, Michael Wood Jr., Boehner Woods, and Perry Hopkins. Today's episode featured the song "All Right" by Kendrick Lamar. Our theme music is by Mark Gunnery. To podcast this segment or share the series with your friends, please visit steinershow.org. And to learn more about Baltimore Traces, visit baltimoretraces.umbc.edu. Please send us your thoughts on what you heard today at talk@steinershow.org or by tweeting @MarkSteiner. Thanks for listening.